Be all that you can be, servant of all. Just what you've always wanted to be, right? Servant of all. Not what I would call a really appealing proposition from Jesus, and yet here it is in our passage this morning. And it is, by the way, a great challenge for those of you who are trying Ryan's challenge of a year of living Christianly. Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem with his disciples. He's just had an encounter with the rich young man or middle-aged man. It doesn't really say what his age is. But he's just had that encounter where he has said to this gentleman, sell all that you have, give what you get from that to the poor, and come and follow me. And then he goes on to say, it will be easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle than it will be for the wealthy to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, following that little challenge to their thinking, the disciples had let Jesus walk ahead of them because, as you read in that passage, they were dismayed and afraid. And Jesus turns to them and says, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be turned over to the chief priests, the scribes, and they will condemn him to death. They will turn him over to the Gentiles, and they will mock him, they will spit on him, they will flog him, they will put him to death, and he will rise again on the third day. Now, in light of what he's just said, it's in this context that these two brothers, James and John, come to him and say, teacher, would you do anything for us that we ask? Now, first of all, I would like to say if anybody comes to you and makes that comment, I suspect that you would be mightily suspicious about what might be coming out of their mouth next. That's not the kind of question that you actually want to say yes to. Now, given the fact that Jesus has, at least three times just prior to this passage, indicated that he is going to be arrested, he's going to be tortured, he's going to die, and yes, he will rise again on the third day, you might expect that these disciples, being as they really do care about him, would say to him, Master, please don't go to Jerusalem. We don't want you to die. Or perhaps all they heard in what he said was that he's going to rise again on the third day. And they were thinking, now after that spectacular event, hopefully in the temple, in front of a few thousand people, Jesus would become king of the Jews, crush the Romans, and rule in power and glory. And they wanted to be there. Not only did they want to be there, they wanted to be his two chief deputies. Who wouldn't? Sounds like a great place to be. Now, this question of theirs is so embarrassing that in the Gospel of Matthew, the writer has James and John's mother asking the question. But it's clear, if you look at the passage, that Jesus is answering them. Mark has it right. They are the ones asking. Now, Jesus is interesting because instead of telling them how wrong they are or what absolute idiots they are, which is what I might have said, he says to them instead, you don't know what you're asking. And he goes on to talk about the cup and the baptism. Now, I did wonder if perhaps I was missing the point. And actually, what we have here is two men who believe so deeply in Jesus that they believed everything would work out, it would be just fine, and this death business would not be a problem. And that perhaps these two men were such models of great faith that all of us should aspire to be like them. Now, I need to tell you that nothing I read indicates that that is what he is talking about, or as that is what we should aspire to become. It's clear in this passage, when Jesus talks about the cup and the baptism, that he is making some very clear points. Now, first of all, the cup. Every month when we have communion, we celebrate the cup. And the cup actually can be a cup of joy or a cup of sorrow. And in this particular passage, it would appear that it is the cup of sorrow, that it is the cup that holds symbolically the blood of Christ, which was shed for us. And it is a cup of sorrow, pain, and death. And that the baptism he is talking about is what you have experienced, or I experienced in my own baptism, or we saw just recently in Marcia's baptism, that as we go beneath the waters, we experience ever so briefly Christ's death, and then we rise again to a new life. But it is a new life that must pass through death first. It also intrigued me that the positions that they want, which are only gained through suffering and death, were the positions that were held by the two thieves, one on the right and one on the left of Christ, as they all waited to die while they were being crucified. And I am sure that those are not the spots that James and John had picked out for themselves. It's also interesting, if you look at the context of this passage, that just prior to this event, Jesus has healed a blind man who then saw clearly. Right after this, he heals Bartimaeus of his blindness. And there's an interesting little contrast there. Two people who barely knew Jesus saw clearly, and these two men who knew him well seemed so blind. When the other 10 disciples catch wind of this conversation, they are furious. And you can read in chapter 9 that they had already started the argument about who was the greatest amongst them. And you can just hear that conversation in your mind. How dare they try and get the two best spots? After all, I was the one he called first. How dare they try and get the two best spots? After all, I called him Messiah first. How dare they try to get the two best spots? I was at the Transfiguration. And it goes on and on, I'm sure. Again, Jesus surprises. He does not tell them how little they understand. Rather, he gives this very small section of teaching that actually is key for the whole future of the community of believers. And it's about this issue of being a servant. And he frames it in this context of how the world handles power and greatness and how his followers are to handle it. And he talks about the tyrants, and he talks about the leaders of the world, and as Ryan said with great emphasis, but it is not to be so amongst you. Whoever wishes to be your leader or great must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first must be slave of all. Now, of course, the great question is, what in the heck does that mean for FBC Edmonton, October 2009? What is Jesus calling us to or asking of us? Now, first of all, Jesus, of course, is the great example that no matter what your salary is, no matter what exalted position you hold in your job, no matter how well-educated you are, or I might say how poorly educated you are, but whatever your definition is of greatness as you see it in the world, he is the example that that is not what counts. Listen to Philippians 2. Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave. Or from today's passage, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. He chose the way. The one who was the king, who had enormous power that we barely understand, says, it is not about being served, it is about serving others. Now, I would like to be very clear about what I believe this does not mean. This does not mean being subservient, being oppressed, being menial, being subjugated, or loss of control over one's own life. After all, the model of servanthood that we follow is found in Jesus. And if you look at his life and how he related to people, it's absolutely clear that he did not grant every request that was made of him. He did not meet every need that was presented to him. And it would seem that we must learn to live with this tension that, yes, a servant meets others' needs, and yet Jesus as servant was clearly not bound to do whatever others asked of him. One of my favorite theologians is Walter Brueggemann, and he puts it this way. Jesus was no less a servant in driving the money changers out of the temple or in rebuking Peter than when he healed people. I'd also like to say this is not about a mindless, every single one of us is to do the same thing. It will be as unique as each one of us is, that as we serve or seek to meet people's needs, it will be appropriate for who we are, what we are able to do, and the people that are in our lives. I believe that whoever it is that God is calling us to serve will already be in our world. And we need to ask God to open our eyes to see who that might be. Now, let me give you an example in my own life from this last week. And not because I am a paragon of virtue when it comes to serving, but because as I was thinking about this, this is what happened to me. As many of you know, Grace, who does our cleaning, has just recently had a sister die. You may not know that her father also died this last week. And as I worked on this sermon, the question confronted me: what do I do to serve Grace? Now, I had noticed that she has been looking particularly tired, and that is not a surprise given what she has dealt with. And I thought, well, I can keep asking her how she is, and I can keep telling her that I will pray for her. However, I had a niggling sense that that's not what this should be about. And I had this thought that came to mind: if she's tired, might it not be appropriate to do something that would lift the weight of her job here? And wouldn't you know it, that thought came the day that it snowed. And Grace's job is to clean the sidewalks and the area out here. Now, I don't know if you've ever shoveled it, but it takes a fair bit of time. And it's hard on the back. And I thought to myself, but that is Grace's job. I don't really want to do it. And yet, I kept thinking, I think that's what I need to do. So I shoveled the snow. Did Grace notice? No, that's not what it's about. It was something in my world, right in front of my eyes, that I was very capable of doing, even though I moaned a bit while I did it. Now, there may be some of us who think that being called to the servant life is kind of beneath us. It's too easy. Other people should do that. There may be men, actually, who think that actually that is the job of women to serve, not men. Men lead, women serve. I'm sure that is not true of any here. So I apologize for saying something that does not apply to you. However, just in case, men or women, think about the person who calls you to serve. He was an incredibly strong man. He grew up as a carpenter. This man had muscles. He had calluses on his hands. He knew what a good sweat was about. He walked miles. He was a brilliant strategist. He dealt with an excruciatingly painful death. He was about strength. And I might say that image of him as being a strong man has been poorly served by generations of church pictures that portray him as weak, limp, and pale looking. This man was strong. And so he knows that when he calls us to this, rather than expecting others to wait on us or serve us, he knows how tough the path is. He knows how much strength it will take to not just meet the needs that everyone asks us to meet, but the ones that we think will be best for them. Now, let me say a word to the women in the audience, especially mothers with young children, who know a lot about serving. If you think this is about a call to become subservient and thus needing to do whatever is asked of you, that is not true. This is a call to a vocation of caring for those Christ has placed in our lives, a vocation that one can choose to accept or can not accept, that a call that requires great strength of self particularly, so that we will not be swallowed up by the needs of those around us. It's also important to remember that as we are called, God promises to equip us. I spent 3.5 years caring for, meeting the needs of, and in other words, serving my mother. It became clear to me pretty quickly that even though this experience was not one that I ever thought I would spend a month doing, let alone 3.5 years, that it was exactly where God wanted me to be. Now, I had a choice to accept that time or to fret and fume and to plot about how I could get out of the experience. I was able to accept it, not out of my own brilliance or insight into God, but I suspect because God helped me to accept it. Did I lose myself in this or feel like I was dying and doing this? No. I actually realized that I was finding myself in some new ways. It was a gift. I actually experienced joy in the doing of it. People would say to me, "This must be very difficult." And the interesting thing is, it was not. It was a gift. There was a sense of joy and life that was freeing in it. Now, I would also like to say that I do not recommend this particular call, caring for one's parents, to all of us. That call was about me. It was about my mother, our past, my relationship with her and redeeming it, and much more. Well, now that I have learned everything there is about servanthood, I am now here to tell you how to do it. That would be wrong, and those of you who know me know it's really wrong. I am here today as one who is still learning, still on the road of what this means, hoping that some of the thoughts today will help stimulate you to think about what this might mean in your own life. And I would like to encourage you to pray that God will open your eyes to the people who are already in your world. This is not about trying to figure out how to serve the entire world. That would be genuinely overwhelming. This is about people who are probably already right around you. Can we, all of us, be at least some of the time like Jesus? Like Mary, like Luke, like John, like Peter, like Paul, and thousands of other believers over the centuries who have said as Mary did, "Here am I, the servant of the Lord. Let it be with me according to your word." And when we are blind, as the disciples were blind, know that Jesus died for us, forgives us, and calls us onward in this adventure of serving all. Amen.